Welcome to Turkey Talk. This week's discussion, we'll be talking about butterball turkeys and how to care for them. How to inject some hot liquid inside of the skin of the turkey. Wrong season? Oh, it's Halloween.
It is. Today is Halloween. And it'd be easy to forget that today is Halloween because we've all been discombobulated by the arrival of a little thing called Sandy.
Yeah, you know, Sandy has a very calming name, right? So I don't ever think a hurricane is going to be that devastating when, oh, Sandy's coming. You know, like, if Sandy's coming, you bake a pie.
Right.
Right? I mean, if Sandy's coming over to your house...
I might tidy up the living room a bit.
Right. You get the couch cleaned up a little bit, fluff the pillows, clean off the futon of the chips and debris, and perhaps you get a hot apple pie ready for her, right?
That's right, Uncle Kevin.
But not this Sandy.
No, this Sandy was a lot like Galactus coming.
So were you affected? You were texting me sort of during the storm. You didn't seem to have any problems evacuating. I mean, you didn't have
no.
to.
No, I would just sit on the toilet. That's how I've always evacuated them. I think I made
that joke like four times with my wife this
past,
during the storm. She's like, well, we have to evacuate. I'm like, well, I just evacuated my bowels. If you know, she's like, that's great. I think I tried to weave that into a couple of.
If you weave it in enough times, eventually she'll like the joke.
Right. That's what I was going for.
Right. Repetition breeds comedy. Didn't she read Richard Belzer's book? Anyway, these are funny words, Clayton. This is a list of funny words. Spatula, spleen. I think we got really, really lucky, especially compared to the fact I'm still hearing from friends or coworkers and things like that who are still being affected by it. We got off really easy.
Yeah. Yeah, we really did. If you think about it, I've been hearing from some people who a friend of mine on Facebook just posted that she, you know, the water is still up to like their second floor of their house. She's sort of trapped. One of our friends from the 40
she's Facebooking while trapped on the third floor of her house.
You know what is kind of remarkable though during
go down and open a window.
During the storm, I mean, we sort of laugh about social media in this, but it was remarkable to see. And so one of my friends was commenting on how isn't it remarkable that all of these people are complaining that their power just went out, and yet they're on Twitter, and they're tweeting that, hey, just lost power. I mean, it is remarkable that the way sort of modern communication that Twitter has been like a go-to resource for emergency, you know, management. And we saw that in Haiti, right? They were actually able to like locate.
Oh, I wasn't in Haiti, but go ahead.
And they're glad to have you if you ever want to go.
I bet they are. I bet they'll take my American dollars real quick.
They actually located people who were trapped like under rubble and debris because they were able to, you know, while electricity was down, they were able to like send like Twitter messages to their family and loved ones, and emergency personnel were able to find these people. So it was
under
amazing.
Under heavy dark rock, hashtag save me.
Right.
Like, oh, he's under the heavy dark one. Let's go.
Hashtag Hurricane Irene. You want to make sure you hashtag those things carefully so people can find you.
Right. After it was downgraded to a post-tropical storm, your hashtags had to change.
Well, because they were really long. Hashtag post-tropical storm Hurricane Irene. So, you know, all these people were tweeting that, hey, you know, we were without power. And so, but they were able to still send out, you know, because Twitter started as like a text messaging service. So even if you didn't have internet service or broadband, you could still send like a text message to Twitter. But our friend Jeff Bacalar from the 404. The CNET show, he apparently, you know, he lives in Hoboken. And, of course, I don't know if you saw, like, some of the damage that happened in Hoboken, but he's still trapped in his apartment. Water is still, like, up to the first floor of their building. He's like, there's nowhere to go. And I was just listening to the news before I got on here. 50 feet of water still in some of the subway tunnels.
Jeez. That sounds like a lot.
Now, listen to this. Now,
I'm listening.
Help me figure this out, detective. You play Robin to my Batman, because I won't have it any other way.
Right. I would really like to be Nightwing.
You play 60s Robin. to my Dark Knight Batman.
Mm, yeah.
Which, by the way, did you see that YouTube video? Is that the, did you send that to me? Or
I sent that to you. Yeah, that's really, really funny.
What was it called, that YouTube video? All of our listeners need to go and watch it right now.
Yeah, I think it was really called something as simple as that. It was like The Dark Knight with 60s Robin.
Right. And it was,
and that's what it was. It's like, it's the modern Dark Knight fighting Bane, and like a Burt Ward style Robin shows up.
Who's just like a little bitchy Robin. He's like, "No, Batman, don't." Yeah.
He's like, "Why'd you tell me to stay in the car?"
Right.
"Are we going for ice cream?"
All of our listeners need to go and watch that right now.
It is very funny. I even watched it a second time. It's very, very funny. You do need a strong stomach for violence, though.
Yeah, there are some very violent scenes in this. And actually, Bane is really well done. Like, they did a really mm-hmm. good job with the costumes.
The costume on 60s Robin is remarkably authentic.
He's got, like, the Peter Pan shoes on.
They even do a joke about that.
Right. So, and I'm trying to remember from the 60s comic book. He had those green little shoes, but did they have like a little Peter Pan tail on them?
Yeah, they were very, very true to the way he was drawn in the comics.
Yeah.
And it's funny that you bring Robin up. I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about that. But anyway, let's indulge this craziness of yours.
Yeah, I want to see if you can – what you think this is, because I looked at my wife when we heard this on the radio today, and I said, why would he have done this? So – you know, right now, I mean, President Obama has been like on the phone with like Chris Christie, like nonstop, dispatching like the Army Corps of Engineers. They have like this elite unit. Have you heard about this?
That sounds like the worst G.I. Joe task force ever.
The Army Corps of Engineers.
Right. Who's on that one? Lifeline and Doc.
So they have this elite unit of like hydrologists that work on the Army Corps of Engineers. You know, these are the people that like, if you've got like a subway flooded,
right?
You call these, like, if your toilet is overflowing from too much evacuating,
right?
You call these guys in, because what they do is they're able to like get all of that water out of a confined space and quickly. I don't know how I don't know how you get good at that, but that's pretty amazing.
Like, you probably have a pump. I'm guessing is that what? And I like that the acronym would be ACE, right? Army Corps of Engineers.
Yeah.
ACE. Yeah. So Chris Christie, for people who don't know, he's that fat guy that's on the news, right?
Right. He's the large governor of New Jersey, who is he's been a rival of President Obama, of course, because he's a Republican, but he's been praising President Obama in the past few days for his. Timeliness and getting him the emergency assistance that they need in New Jersey, and of course, New Jersey has just been decimated,
reduced by 1/10.
So, right. So they anyway. Nevertheless, there was a news report today, because you have these MTA workers that are they're like down in the tunnels right now dealing with like the Army Corps of Engineers. They have to try to get, so you have like a 3-pronged problem, right? So. And in some ways, it's like a chicken and the egg thing. What do you start with first? You've got all this water in the subway tunnels. So to restore service, you need to obviously get electricity back up and running within those tunnels. So the first thing obviously you'd need to do is, reduce the amount of water in these tunnels. Mm. Well, how do you get the water out when you can't really get into the tunnels because they're flooded? So it's a conundrum.
Mm.
Anyway. So these MTA workers are down in these tunnels, and they're working with the Army Corps of Engineers to remove this water. And some random guy comes down. Now, this is where I need your detective skills. He comes down with fake – now, bear in mind, like all of lower Manhattan is underwater right now, without power, like a war zone.
Mm-hmm.
A guy shows up with fake MTA credentials trying to go down into the tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
And they like shuffle him off, and he's been arrested as a result of it. I looked at my wife, and I'm like, "What is the motivation?" Right? It's not like you're looting. Like, I could understand if there was like a Best Buy underneath the tunnels, and he was like trying to get down there to get his hands on a Laserdisc player. What would be the motivation for a guy to have fake MTA credentials in an effort to get into these flooded subway tunnels?
He's obviously a frustrated volunteer. Like, he's tried times in the past when the MTA has really needed him, in those previous like war zone like times for lower Manhattan. And he's been frustrated by being denied access to the inner workings of whatever it is MTA stands for and whatever they do. So as a way around this bit of bureaucracy, he had fake credentials made so that he could be one of the team. Of course, what he doesn't realize is only four people work for the MTA. So when the fifth guy comes down the stairs and he flashes, and they're like, "Wait a minute!"
They're like, "Wait, you weren't
at the office this morning.
You didn't bring donuts last week, like on our weekly rotation of donut bringing.
Haul that guy away." Yeah, I don't know. People are bored, Clayton. People are dumb.
See,
and let me tell
you
something.
I would say
people just want to fit in. This is a true thing. I heard this story a while ago about a homeless guy who would save up, whatever he would get from panhandling, and when he would have enough, he would go into – this is in our hometown of Redding in Berks County – that he would go into a local restaurant and sit down and just, have a normal meal, even though he stank and, he was all unkempt and his clothes were probably rotting right off of his body and everything else, and just acted like he was anybody else because he wanted to fit in. For that 1 hour that he sat there, he wanted to fit in and just be like everybody else. And maybe this guy was like, "This is it for me. I only come out of my apartment once every 7 years. I've been sitting on these photoshopped MTA credentials. I'm going down in the tunnels. This is my time."
See, Robin, this is why I keep you in the car.
Mm-hmm.
I think this – I don't know. Part of me, with obviously given the opportunistic nature of terrorists,
right?
I thought to myself, this is sort of one of those perfect times – for somebody to come out of the woodwork and try to get down into the tunnels and to have some, unfettered access to an area that might otherwise be completely off limits to them with normal amounts of security and electricity and security cameras. Here you have no power, no security cameras, and you just have people doing what they can to try to get things back up and running down there. And here comes a guy with fake MTA credentials trying to get it down into the subway to try to do something.
Mm-hmm. Well, Clayton, I must admit that it sounds to me as if you were charged with the same post-Occupy Wall Street zeitgeist cynicism as The Dark Knight Rises. and that's, of course, lifted directly from an asinine review of the film. It seems very cynical of you that you would think this guy's a terrorist who wishes to have unfettered
access to the inner workings of
a flooded tunnel.
Look, I'm Batman.
I think it's probably just a volunteer.
Look, I'm Batman, and I need to be aware of people's darker natures. I'm like Dexter, right? Is there a sliver of light in you? I hope there is, but for the most part, I believe you're darkness. So I'm going to track you that way. And my wife said, "Well, maybe this guy is one of those guys who lives in the tunnels." She said that her sister is convinced there's all sorts
of
tunnel people, right? They live in these tunnels.
Sure.
I have to think sort of like Lex Luthor in Superman. He has like an underground tunnel structure that you're worried about, right? What was his name with the little fat guy with the hat that gets like,
Otis?
Otis, yeah. You're like Otis. Maybe he was like Otis trying to get back to his criminal mastermind.
Right. He's the Ned Beatty.
Right.
The Gene Hackman that's waiting in the tunnel lair. And
Mrs. Tessbacher is down there too, right?
People are no good. That's what Lex Luthor says. But land people will always need.
The worst plot of any superhero.
He's a real
film.
Estate maven. It does take a very sinister turn in the third act, incidentally. But that Christopher Reeve Superman film. Oh, that's so good. Sit down right now and watch it. If I had 2 hours and 40 minutes. It's a really long film.
It really is.
Yeah, it is. Hey, so some things that you brought up. One, I found out actually as early as 1982 this was in the works, actually, the plot of the G.I. Joe miniseries in which Cobra attempts to assemble a weather dominator.
Right. I saw your tweet about this, by the way.
And that was a long – Clayton, if you think – 1982 was 30 years ago.
Right.
30 years ago, someone who wrote the G.I. Joe cartoon miniseries had this idea, and probably someone before. And I had tweeted out that why is it the U.S. government, who almost every year I've paid them some taxes, why is it that they haven't built one of these yet to deal with these types of storms? And I got a few people who tweeted me back and said that there is such a thing. It's called like the HAARP or something like that.
No, that's the senior citizens. Is it the AARP? Is that the Senior Citizens Alliance?
Well, it started with an H.
Oh.
But I had no idea what this thing was that they were talking about, and I couldn't be bothered to Google it. But I just thought there must be, you know, like, can't we get our top meteorologist? Maybe we pull somebody off the Army Corps of Engineers, and we get to work on this because I've got to think with, you know, the capabilities that we have, right? We could, if let's say, for example, that we had any clue for all those years where Osama bin Laden was, we probably could have put, like, a rocket into his back pocket from, like, the other side of the planet, if we had to. Like, technologically, there are probably very few things we're incapable of. And apparently there's some very smart folks over in Asia who could help, too. And I understand they get, like, tsunamis over there all the time.
I know that they have, like, special seeding programs. You can fly over, like, small aircraft over clouds and can actually help it to rain.
Hmm. Right. Well, I think what I'm looking for here is something to stop it.
Oh, you want to – what about a giant sponge?
Yes. I think that's a great idea. I just have to imagine – I don't know a lot about it, but there must be some way that you could affect clouds or, like, you aim a big laser on top of your HISS tank at the eye of a hurricane and it blows up.
Right.
Or something like that. And I just – I feel like you know, a lot of very influential politicos listen to this because Clayton is on the show. You know, Clayton's very influential in that sphere. He once even co-founded a book club with Karl Rove. And based on the fact that we have so many important and influential policymakers, like that fat guy from New Jersey and the president, I would like for you to make the weather dominator. That's all I'm going to say about that. I want to say this about Robin. I was thinking about this earlier. Robin has come up in a number of discussions here on the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe, and we've talked about him from a variety of different angles. We've even off the podcast, because Clayton and I oftentimes converse without the benefit of you listening in, about Robin as recently as just a few weeks ago. We're talking about Robin action figures.
Right, and how difficult it is to find a Robin action figure. And I hadn't really ever thought that would be that difficult, but it is. No one wants them.
Well, they're very elusive in that, you know, compared to the number of Batman figures. Like, I was looking at, I think they released 5 waves of Batman the Animated Series action figures. And in most of those waves, you'll have 2 or 3 Batmen, you know, 1 or 2 different villains, like a Joker and then maybe Killer Croc, and then maybe 1 other character. So maybe in that assortment you get a Robin, but maybe that assortment you get Alfred instead, or maybe you get Commissioner Gordon, or... you get a Bruce Wayne figure, you know. So the Robin figures, for whatever reason, are just very difficult to come by. And anyway, that's neither here nor there. But we're talking about – this is back when Michael Uslan was on the program, sort of the executive producer of everything Batman since the 1989 Michael Keaton reinvention of the character, is that Robin does not appeal to younger fans because they cannot be Robin. Robin is a child like them, and he's already Robin. You know, he's a circus acrobat whose parents were killed. He trained under Batman. Now he's Robin. But if you're a kid and you're reading a Batman comic book or enjoying Batman through any of the other types of media that he's available through, you can't be Robin. It's too late. Much in the same way as I lamented about a year ago or so on this very program, now I'm too old to be Batman. But I had a huge window of time where being Batman was still a viable option.
Right.
Robin, however, not a viable option. When I was a kid, I was like, oh, I'm not a circus performer. I'm not currently being trained for this role, but I could grow up to be Batman. And something that had kind of dawned on me about, you know, there was a long stretch of time when the number one selling comic book in the United States was Captain Marvel. He outsold Superman. He outsold Batman. This is, you know, really before... the Marvel stuff kicked up a notch in the 60s. I'm talking about, let's say...
Was this pre-Amazing Spider-Man, right?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. They had been sued out of existence by DC before the Silver Age really began. I want to say the last, like, true Captain Marvel comic was published in 1953.
Hmm.
Because DC had sued them. And I'll tell you this story real quick, if you're interested to know it. That Captain Marvel for at least 3 years was outselling all of the DC books. I think back then DC was still called whatever they were back then. They weren't yet DC Comics. Maybe they were. I don't know. But Captain Marvel, and to tell you, Captain Marvel is a little boy. His name is Billy Batson, and when he speaks a magic word, the name of the wizard who gave him his powers, Shazam, he turns into Captain Marvel. And that's really unique, in that when you think about who the target for those comic books in that era was, we're talking like post-World War II, even World War II era, because Captain Marvel was definitely part of that World War II era boom and those types of pulps and things like that. That type of wish fulfillment does resonate with younger kids, because he's still Billy Batson. He's still just a normal kid with a paper route. You know, that was his thing. I think after a while they trumped it up. Do you remember he would, like, read the news on the radio? Like, he was a very special reporter. But
right.
That was his deal. Like, he was like a newspaper boy. And all he had to do was say that magic word, and he turned into Captain Marvel, the mightiest mortal on the planet.
It's like what's so appealing about the movie Big, starring Tom Hanks, right?
Yes.
Sort of fantastical idea that you can go and touch a video game and suddenly become, you know, big and old. It's every little kid's dream, right?
To be old.
Right. Old and decrepit.
When you're a little kid, the two things you want to do most of all, one, you want to vote. Right? That's all you care about. Like, when will my vote matter?
Right.
And two, you want to drink. That's it. That's all kids really care about.
And drive.
At the same, they want to vote, drink, and drive all at the same time.
same day.
That's right, yeah. I was just thinking about that, like how that contributed to the popularity of Captain Marvel, because as I was discovering that, the fact that, like, at times he outsold Superman and Batman combined.
That's crazy talk.
It is crazy. When you think of, to our generation, Captain Marvel is like a trivial character, you know? So what happened was DC claimed that there were too many similarities between Captain Marvel and Superman, and they took him to court over it. And even though Fawcett was the name of the company that published Captain Marvel, even though it seemed very, very unlikely that DC could win, they didn't want to fight the lawsuit. They thought it'd be too costly to litigate it. And in their minds, comic books were just trash literature. Like, we'll just stop this one and start a new character. Who cares? Like, why spend any time or money and effort fighting this when, you know, we're talking about comic books, which at the time were, as I said, they were just like trash literature. So instead of, you know, fighting them in court to keep Captain Marvel, they reached an out-of-court settlement, which included the terms that Fawcett would never again publish Captain Marvel. They would never publish another comic book with Captain Marvel in it. And so, like, the last, I think, issue of anything even remotely Captain Marvel, like, hit the newsstands, I want to say in 1953, give or take. A real comic book historian could probably correct me on that. And then, shortly thereafter, without their flagship character, Fawcett folded and was purchased. They were bought up by DC Comics. So in the end, DC ended up owning Captain Marvel. But they were content to let him gather dust. And during this period of time is when Marvel trademarked the name Captain Marvel. So that's why, of course, now when you see stuff in the market space, he's typically referred to as Shazam. In fact, this year, DC even officially changed the character's name to Shazam because they can't market him as Captain Marvel, even though that's his name and they can call him that. You'll never see a comic book with that on the cover produced by DC. So it's always, you know, it's like the titles of the books have been like The Power of Shazam or With One Magic Word, Shazam. That's where you see the Captain Marvel family of characters, because Marvel has their own Captain Marvel. In fact, they have a few. They have a Captain Marvel who was featured in the first Marvel graphic novel ever, which came out in the early 80s, and he died of cancer, which was like a landmark thing that had never happened before in comic books. Then do you remember there was the female Captain Marvel who was in the Avengers? She had like a white costume. Do you remember that?
Yeah, did she have, though, a lightning bolt on her?
No, she just had like a black star in the center of her chest, and she had a horrible white costume. And she was in the Avengers, like when the Avengers were like Dr. Druid, Star Fox, She-Hulk, the Black Knight.
During that
worst lineup of Avengers ever, she was in it. They later changed her name to Photon.
She wasn't in Alpha Flight, was she?
No. Oh, you're thinking of Snowbird.
That's right. Yeah.
That's really weird that you bring up Alpha Flight. I just saw a picture of that awful Alpha Flight character, Box, this morning. But so nevertheless, Yeah, I was just kind of thinking about that. And so anyway, yeah, Captain Marvel is still out there. And but like I said, he's kind of trivial compared to what he was in his heyday when he really was like the number one superhero on the scene. But yeah, I was kind of thinking about that. Like, I think that's why that character at that time was so very, very popular, because you look at those other characters like Robin, right? Captain America in the war, back then he had his wartime sidekick Bucky, all those kid sidekicks that were deliberately meant to attract the younger viewers, or the younger readers at the time, I should say. They just didn't work, but Captain Marvel did, because of that simple premise that Billy Batson just, you know, he said the magic word and he transformed into Captain Marvel, and at the end of the day, he was just Paperboy Billy Batson again.
See, that's brilliant marketing. I mean, that's what every kid's, you know, kid's aspirational, right? They want to be big like that. They want to be able to fight crime. But I look at the famous Alec, you know, like Alex Ross painting of Robin, Robin and Batman with like the spotlight shining on them. You know which painting I'm talking about?
I know exactly the one you mean, yeah.
And, you know, I don't understand. And I guess, you know, when Bob Kane created it, created Robin, I guess maybe Bill Finger and Jerry Robinson were all tied together in creating Robin back in the day. What were they thinking, right? Because like the idea behind Batman is that he's this dark character. He lives in the dark. He's been crafted after a bat. He needs the shadow. He needs the darkness to scare his prey. And then he's going to team up with a guy. So they're also in the darkness, but in a guy like with a yellow, bright satin cape. Right? With tights on, almost no pants.
Right, he's wearing green Speedos.
With Peter Pan shoes on, mm-hmm. with a red jacket, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's absurd. I just don't know what they were thinking. I mean, I guess they wanted to try to provide some counterbalance to the darker Batman, but it made no sense. I mean, from the canon, it makes no sense.
Well, I think
he'd be
probably,
better served being Superman's, you know, sidekick.
Right, given the brightness of the costumes and everything.
How did, by the way, did you remember that Robin, and I don't even know if it's still around, but it was when Tim Drake was, Tim Drake was like the third iteration of Robin, right?
Yeah, yeah. In continuity he was, yeah.
Right. And then they had that comic book. I remember it was sort of, and I don't remember, I think I was still buying comic books this year in 1991 at the time. I'm trying to remember what else was out that time. But you had Robin, the comic book that I think launched in 1991. Or maybe it was a little bit later. Maybe it was like right before I was heading off to college, like 93, 94.
It was definitely during the speculator boom. That's when the new Robin really hit.
Yeah. But I just remember Tim Drake being the character, and it was like one-off book. And I'm trying to think, was it ever successful? Did it survive? Is it still around? I have no idea.
They did at least two or three miniseries that were kind of about Tim Drake as Robin, and then he got his own ongoing series. And during that time when those three miniseries, because I think they were even just called Robin 1, Robin 2, and Robin 3, with Roman numerals behind his name in that, like, Robin font. And Tim Drake definitely had more depth to him than the previous Robin, Jason Todd, did. No two ways about that. But that was during that time when every cover had a hologram on it.
Right, right.
Every cover was embossed or debossed. It was like metallic variant cover two.
Like you could rub his muscles.
That was right of that era, the speculator boom era, where they were doing all those variant covers because everyone thought, I'm going to be the guy that buys the one rare comic book that no one else has, and I'm going to make $1 million. And there are certain laws of supply and demand we all ignored. Like if we all bought 10 copies of Robin number one, they're all going to be worth roughly cover price or even less. Like those are the comics you find now when you go to a comic convention, like in the quarter bin. You bought them for $1.75 back in the day, and now they sell for 25 cents right. Because everyone has 500 copies of them. They don't matter. Incidentally, on an Alex Ross front, I passed his table at New York Comic Con. He had his binder of sketches out. His sketches started at $5,000 a sketch.
Jeez Louise.
Right. I was dumbfounded by this. And he also has an entourage.
Was he
like,
even there? Because when I saw the Alex Ross booth at San Diego Comic-Con, mm-hmm. I mean, it was a massive booth unto itself.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
I mean, it was not like just a little table. It was a massive booth. And he wasn't even there. It was like all of these people like in Alex Ross t-shirts that were like handling things.
Right. He is a cottage industry unto himself. But he really is. He's like, in terms of comic book art, like he's the true superstar of the last 20 years, Alex Ross. People from outside comic books know who he is. There was like an entourage of people huddled around one guy sitting in a chair with his back to me, but I really did think it was him. I've seen various pictures of him. I was always charmed by the fact that there was a great photo of him that was run in a Wizard a magazine all about how he works. And right over his easel or wherever it is that he works in his home where he does his painting, he had a framed photo of the monkeys.
That's cool.
I always remember that about him. But it did seem like – otherwise there was much fuss about nothing. But it seemed like this entourage had like encircled him. And there were – but just as you said, it was – one, it was a massive booth considering it's one man. And he had like a team of people that were handling – if you wanted to look at one of the sketches up close, they'd take it out of the special container thing it was in. But it was just enough like – I almost didn't even want to touch it. You know what I mean? Like, you could page through this book that he had, but you could also see what the prices were in the upper corner. And I just thought, I'm not even touching that book.
Like, I think I looked at that very same book, and my jaw dropped.
Yeah.
I think the cheapest thing was a business card that he had.
Yeah. So the business card was only $100.
Yeah.
I think this is about Robin. I think that, one, it may have come from the editorial ship, that they were really in a mode where they were trying to make it accessible to younger readers. And they said, you need something that hooks them, like Captain America's Bucky. Captain Marvel Jr. was to Captain Marvel.
But, I mean, that's the question. Did it work? Because
they don't know. Like, there weren't focus groups that looked into that sort of thing for the same reason we just mentioned. Like, the publishers of this just thought it was trash. It was throwaway literature that didn't matter. You didn't need continuity from one month to the next. You didn't have to worry if the art was terrible. You didn't have to worry about any of those things because, well, as long as they're selling on the newsstand this week, that's all that matters. And if next week the new fad is Western comic books or next week it's romance comics or horror comics, we're all going to ditch the superheroes and move on to the next thing. Who cares?
But I guess, I mean, wouldn't they be able to track sales? I mean, that would be an obvious.
Well, do you know that story about Amazing Fantasy 15 and the sales for that? That Amazing Fantasy, which is the book that launched Spider-Man,
right,
was set to be canceled. It was doing terrible at the newsstands. And Stan Lee and Steve Ditko had this character that they'd been pushing to get into print. Spider-Man is the character. And they, as a throwaway, put it in the last issue of Amazing Fantasy. Amazing Fantasy had been canceled. So they knew the book had no future, and I guess to appease them, they said, put your story in this. Then, months later, when the sales figures came in, they realized that Spider-Man was a huge hit. But they didn't know it for months. Stan Lee often said, the only way we even knew that people were liking it was we started to get a lot more letters at the office from fans. But he said it took months before the sales numbers came in, and we realized Spider-Man was already the number one superhero in the company.
Wow.
So I think it was just very, very slow. And even from my time working in magazine publishing, like the turnarounds at the newsstand are incredibly slow. Even in the 90s, it was you'd wait 90 days to get even rough numbers back. I can only imagine what it was like. We're talking about Amazing Fantasy 15 was what, 1963?
Right. Yeah, 1963,
give or take.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can only imagine, like, in an age that predates computers and perhaps more efficient methods of tallying publication numbers and things like that, they probably didn't really have a sense of that. And you're right. Like, Robin is such a bizarre anomaly in that way. And there are tons of creators out there for that exact reason that never want to deal with Robin because they can't make him make sense. And one of the writers, and I don't even remember who did this, it was definitely like in the late 70s. It was kind of like when DC was trying to recover with Batman from the camp era and draw him back into like being a little more dark. Denny O'Neil was writing it. That's when, what is that that artist's name? He's a gorgeous artist. Marshall Rogers, I want to say, was his name. And they made Batman very dark and gothic again, that they kind of retroactively told the story of how Alfred begged Robin to be like the bright counterpoint to Batman. And he said, I'm losing Bruce Wayne. Like, he's so lost in this guilt trip and this never-ending quest for revenge against this thing that he'll never beat. And he needs someone that, like, makes him bright. Like, he needs somebody to care for, and you need to be that. And you can't be a dark reflection like he is. And it was really like Alfred that motivated him to do it. And, you know, they kind of, whether it was just by coincidence or not, they kind of touched on that in the one Batman movie where the Chris O'Donnell Robin actually says that Alfred's the one that made his costume.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think they even and even in the terrible Batman and Robin, or was it Batman Forever?
Yeah.
When he basically he makes a Robin's costume for him.
Yeah, that's what I just said.
Oh, I thought you said in the comics, sorry.
You don't listen when I'm talking, Morris.
No, I did. To be honest, there was some Skype dropouts, but I was hoping that your track was picking it up. But did he do that in the comic books though?
Well, I think there was kind of like a retroactive story that made it seem that way, as they tried to, you know, as they were taking Batman away from,
yeah,
right, like the post TV series era where it was really goofy and campy, like every other month Batman's in outer space and like
right.
he's doing things that Batman's really not meant to be doing, that they tried to make sense of Robin in that way. But you can understand why some people are like, they are afraid of Robin, because it can be very, very difficult to make him make sense.
Well, like Christopher Nolan didn't want to have anything to do with him.
Right. And I think that's why some of them, like, they love having Nightwing there as an alternative, because Nightwing fits in better with Batman's overall aesthetic. And in a way, I mean, they didn't do it exactly this way, but the fact that they killed the second Robin the way they did, I think they were, like, showing you, like, these are the impracticalities of having, like, a 15-year-old boy dressed in primary colors as your sidekick.
Right. Especially when you have an arch nemesis as the Joker.
Yeah. We should stop here, Clayton.
What's that?
We should stop. We should stop the podcast right now. I have a ton of other things that I wanted to talk about, but we need to thank one of our great show sponsors. We are very, very fortunate to have with us here on the podcast and helping us here at the Grizzly Productions Network, which allows us to deliver this content to you free week in and week out. They are the innovators, the trailblazers, and you're going to want to go check them out. I'm talking about Squarespace.com, Clayton.
These guys are incredible. If you're thinking about building a website and you don't want it to look cheesy and you want it to look professional and you want to build it quickly, so you're a restaurant, you're an auto dealership, whatever you happen to be, you're thinking about launching a small business. And I've talked to a couple of our listeners who've said they've been meaning and wanting to do this, and now with Squarespace, that has been the impetus, and they are going to do it. So this is great. You go over to squarespace.com/grizzly, so we get credit for pointing you in that direction. And then just hang out there for a little bit, you know, play the demo videos, see what they have to offer, visit the templates section so you can actually see. You can actually take one of their beautifully designed templates, so you don't have to worry about building it from the ground up. And it's drag and drop. So where they've got some placeholder text, you just write in your own text. You want to put photos in there? Drag in your very own photos. Reposition them, resize them. You can drag them around the screen. You don't have to know how to write any code at all. I remember in college, Mike and I went to the same college. I remember taking this like HTML5 or this HTML class in college, having to write code, and just to put like a picture on the page. You know how long that took? I think I built like a Bruce Lee website back in college, because we all had to build like a website for the class. And I built like sort of a brochure history or biography style website about Bruce Lee. Mm-hmm. I mean, to put a photo in there and to like have to resize it, you had to like go back in, rewrite some code. With Squarespace, you don't have to do any of that. And it has responsive design. What does that mean? That means you upload one photo, and then that photo, Squarespace resizes for you six different ways so that it shows up on your mobile device, your tablet, your desktop. That photo that you uploaded looks great for anyone who's looked at it. I don't know. When you look at like Chikara's traffic, do you get a lot of like mobile traffic? People, can you see like where people are coming and checking out your website?
I'm sure there's a way to look at that. You know, that's not really my department. But I do know, just for example, every once and again, like looking at YouTube analytics,
right,
that over 65 – this is an average number I'm saying. We average more than 65% viewers via mobile.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
so
that sounds
that's how
right.
People are experiencing the web now. Like people are checking it out, you know, on their smartphone or on their super robot or whatever.
Yeah, and that's the way that people are looking at – like I built this new photography website on Squarespace called photographybegins.com. And overwhelmingly – I mean the analytics that Squarespace gives you are incredible. So I can see not only the operating system that people are using to check out my site. I think it's like an overwhelming number of people are looking at it using Mac OS 10 as the operating system. Then Windows 7, I think, is underneath that. I can see which browser they're using. Are they using Chrome? Are they using Safari? Are they using mobile Safari on their iPhone? Are they using Android to come and visit? All of these analytics are built into Squarespace. So if I want to find out if Twitter is the biggest driver of traffic to me, I can see that all within Squarespace. You know, if I send out a tweet, is that where most people are coming to my site because I sent out a tweet with a link in it? Or are they coming from Facebook? Are they coming from Google+? And I mean, think about your business, right? You can reposition your assets based on what, you know, where people are coming from. So all of these things built into Squarespace, and it's just so easy to use. And their plans are really cheap. They start at $8 a month. They have two plans, $8 and $16.
Mm-hmm.
And the $16 a month gives you unlimited pages you can create, unlimited bandwidth, really incredible support. They just do such an incredible job. And if you're going to sign up for a site, we'll give you 10% off the life of your website at Squarespace. 10% by putting in the coupon code BARB, B-A-R-B. What is BARB short for?
Well, it could be short for Barbara. But in this case, it is short for barbarian. It is short for barbarian. So BARB. Get on this. You don't have long. Get on this. Save some money. You'll be glad that you did.
Yeah. Go to squarespace.com/grizzly and use that coupon code BARB. We thank them so much for their support. So I wanted to talk with you about this because I thought this was – at first I thought this headline this week was a joke. I thought it was an Onion headline. And I tweeted as such earlier, and I'll pull up the headline. Disney buys Lucasfilm. Plans to release Star Wars Episode 7 in 2015. I thought, that's a joke, right? Mm-hmm. That's got to be a joke. But it's not.
Nope.
Disney has continued its incredible buyout success of certain companies like Marvel and adding it to the Disney Entertainment Universe. I mean, boy, did they hit a home run by buying Marvel ahead of the Avengers launch.
Yeah.
Think about that, right? Now they're buying the entire Star Wars universe. And, you know, I think maybe a lot of us probably just think of the Star Wars films, right? But Disney is buying Lucasfilm.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives them everything, right? That gives them Star Wars Lego games. That gives them... that gives them the Clone Wars series.
Right, which is hugely successful.
Yeah, and I can imagine the toy rights alone would be incredible.
If the amount of shelf space that the Clone Wars commands at my local Target is any indication, it must be huge. And it's weird because to me, like, every subsequent iteration of Star Wars loses some of the magic to me. That original three, you know, what are referred to as episodes 4, 5, and 6, are the most remarkable.
Right.
And with each subsequent iteration, they become less remarkable. So I can only hope that somehow they return some magic to the franchise.
And that's what that's what's going on. And, you know, George Lucas gave an interview just this week. He put it up on YouTube, actually. In the future of Star Wars, and he says, "Look, you know, I've been planning to retire for several years now, and I wanted to get into sort of another stage of life where I'm not in the film business anymore, and where I don't have to run a corporation."
Mm-hmm.
And he said it occurred to me that one day that the perfect person to run the company was Kathy Kennedy, Lucasfilm co-chair. Such a perfect fit, and I felt that I really wanted to put the company somewhere in a larger entity that would protect it. Disney is a huge corporation. They have all kinds of capabilities and facilities. There's a lot of strength to be gained by this. And he says, you know, he points to the success that Disney has had with Marvel and Pixar.
Mm-hmm.
That they're family-friendly company, legendary theme parks, merchandising power. He said it was just the logical choice for Lucasfilm. Mm-hmm. So he says, I have. So he's actually written the film treatments for 7, 8, and 9. Mm-hmm. And
they Which doesn't fill me with confidence based on 1, 2, and 3.
Right, but then again, he also wrote 4, 5, and 6.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there are 17,000 characters in the Star Wars universe. I had no idea there were that many characters in this. 17,000 characters. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. I can't imagine. I mean, in my mind now, I think of the 6 Star Wars films and that's it. Mm-hmm. I wonder if turning over the reins, he just has no choice, right? He's going to do it, and then, hey, they're going to get it, you know? He's always said, and he says in this interview, I've always said I wasn't going to do any more films, and that's true. I'm not going to do it anymore. He's not going to write or direct the upcoming films, which is good news for fans because he is not a good director.
Yeah.
You know, I think when he stepped away, like he directed the first Star Wars, right? And then he stepped away. He was an executive producer, and Empire Strikes Back was not directed by him.
Right.
It was Blockbuster.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, it's always with some trepidation that I read about these kinds of things because, as I said, it seems like the law of diminishing returns. Every subsequent iteration contains less magic. But, on the other hand, who knows? You know, there's a generation of people that grew up with the magic of Star Wars that now can lend their creativity to it because Lucas himself is no longer at the helm. You know, they have the opportunity to go out and bring on the best possible people to do this, so...
Right, and there are those great books, too. I'm trying to remember the name of those books that I read. They're in the Star Wars. A lot of people were wondering if they were going to be used as the film treatments. Those Star Wars paperbacks and the Star Wars... Mm-hmm. What was his name, the author of those books? Not Peter David.
No, he did the Star Trek stuff.
Oh, shoot. It's right on the tip of my tongue.
Yeah,
you know which books I'm talking about,
I know what you're talking
about,
but I don't know.
They take place a year after... A year or 2 years after Jedi, don't they? Or is it like a year after Empire and before Jedi? I don't know. I think it's – no. It's because they have a child. So Solo and Leia have a child, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The Hans – Timothy Zahn books. Am I right on that? Timothy Zahn?
Timothy Zahn. You could be right.
Look those up. But
that is an author, but –
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not going to come out and say that I think necessarily he's the author.
I mean, and
yeah,
I know
what you're talking about.
Fans were – it's called the Thrawn trilogy. Oh, Heir to the Empire. The Heir to the Empire trilogy, written by Timothy Zahn. I was right. The novels are set in the expanded universe of Star Wars Galaxy, approximating 5 years after the events depicted in The Return of the Jedi. The series introduced many notable characters. Yeah, and Zahn's treatment of Thrawn included the original element of artistic analysis of cultures. Thrawn devised military strategy, blah, blah, blah. Really, really good. I mean, Dark Horse – I think I remember Dark Horse Comics had adopted them, didn't they?
Yes. You know, right after the first wave of popularity, Marvel had the Star Wars license, and they produced at least 100 issues of a Star Wars comic book series – which I did not care for as a kid because it was clearly outside the accepted continuity. And then, yeah, for a while, I think it was Dark Horse had it.
Yeah. So a lot of people love these books. I mean, they're really well done. I think they offer a really great, you know, jumping off point for somebody else to come in and do, you know, to do something really special with the Star Wars universe. And I think a lot of fans at the time, myself included, were wondering when we were hearing that Lucas was going to do 3 new Star Wars films, we immediately thought that he was going to do follow-ups, right? Post, you know, 7, 8, 9. None of us, I think, thought he was going to do prequels at the time.
Yeah.
But everyone was sort of clamoring, hoping that he was going to take the Timothy Zahn books as the template.
Mm-hmm.
He did not. And he went with the prequel. Of course, he then, in interviews, talked about how the prequels, for him, he always wanted to do them, but technologically, he couldn't do them in the 1970s and early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
It was impossible.
Right.
So the 3 books from 1991, 1992, and 1993, Heir to the Empire, Dark Force Rising, and The Last Command. I need to go back and reread those. Those were really good books.
All right. Well, I'm going to take this opportunity to tell you a little bit about our longstanding show sponsor here at Grizzly Productions, not just of this podcast, but of several others, including Daddy on Board, Cobra Electronics. These are not the makers of the Weather Dominator, although I wish they would be.
Yeah, they could get on that.
If they weren't so busy making radar, laser detectors, GPS navigation, and stuff like that, they could probably go make this Weather Dominator, and I'd love it if I could mount it on my dash. They've just released, in time for the holiday gift buying season, the latest and greatest. It's called the Vedetta. You see, I always want to say Vendetta.
Right.
But it's Vedetta. It's Vedetta. This is a brand new series from our friends over at Cobra Electronics, and they are setting the standard higher than ever for radar and laser detection. This new line, the Vedetta, comes with a color LCD display. It can be mounted virtually anywhere on your windshield or dashboard. And not only does this deliver unparalleled performance and range, but it also boasts an integrated GPS receiver and gives you free lifetime access to the Aura Driving Hazard National Database. That means that you're going to have up-to-date, verified and re-verified information about known speed traps, red light cameras, etc., etc., delivered to you in real time. The Cobra Vedetta Ultimate Detection Systems are designed to maximize your comfort, your safety, and your situational awareness of the driving environment all around you. This makes a great gift idea for you or for somebody you got to buy something for. So go over and find out about the Vedetta and tons of other great products, from the iRadar to the Tag, the enormous and innovative, I want to call them gizmos.
Yeah, gadgets.
Gadgets.
Yeah.
Innovations. Techno whatnot. From our awesome show sponsors over at Cobra Electronics. Show them some love, would you please?
They gave some great stuff away on our 200th episode. And to all of those of you who won, they needed your phone numbers for FedEx delivery. So you should have received a tweet and or a message regarding your phone number, so they can add that to the FedEx delivery. If you haven't already given us your phone numbers, please do so. Just direct message us on the Grizzly Bear Cafe Twitter account, so that way we can add that and get that right over to Cobra so they can get those out to you. Hey, in the meantime, you had texted me something about JLA, which was pretty cool, but I was over on superherohype.com.
Right, that's where this story was.
Yeah, that's where you sent me to go look at it, and I noticed, though, while I was there to look at these DC and Kia Motors unveiling the new Hero-inspired vehicles that you had sent me, that there's a whole article about George Lucas and Star Wars over there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I didn't realize, though, that they're planning a trilogy mm-hmm. in 2015. Like, it's not just going to be one film.
Right.
They're planning to do a whole new Star Wars trilogy,
mm-hmm.
which I was not aware of.
Yeah, where there's money to be made.
Right. Why wouldn't they? So yeah, there you go. Timothy Zahn books. They're already made. Go grab them.
I didn't know this when I was looking at these pictures. I was really stunned when I saw these things, that Kia Motors teamed up with DC, and they had some cars that were kind of like co-produced, I guess you want to say, with like West Coast Customs.
Are these mass-produced or just for like just a special edition?
That's the thing. You know what? If they mass produce these, I think these things would sell like hotcakes.
Yes.
They're ultimately doing 7 of them in the line. 5 of them have been made public now. They have a Batman-inspired car, one of the Flash, one of Aquaman, one of Green Lantern, and one of Cyborg. They have yet to unveil the Wonder Woman and Superman-inspired Kias, but they're only making 1 of each of these, and they're going to be auctioned off.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I was, and this is basically being done to raise awareness of DC's We Can Be Heroes campaign. But I really thought, like, you remember around the time of one of the Transformers movies, they released whoever makes it, like, Bumblebee, and you could really buy him.
Yeah.
Like, and it came with, like, the Autobot iconography on it and everything else, like, on the hubcaps and stuff. I still see those cars out there now. Like, and no offense, but, like, Batman and the Flash and Green Lantern are way more marketable than Bumblebee.
Right. And I think that even Cyborg, the car looks awesome.
It does, yeah. I mean, wouldn't even know that it's...
Right. I mean, it doesn't look like it's ridiculous. I mean, it actually looks pretty darn cool. And so it's silver. It has mm-hmm. It has like a raised thing on the front of the hood with almost like a red, like, laser gun. The Batman one is pretty cool. I mean, it's all slate gray, and then wrapping around the exterior is a bat signal. And the hubcaps are yellow with the black the spokes are black, and there's yellow beneath it, so it kind of looks like the bat signal. Looks pretty darn sweet. What's your favorite one?
I like the fact, like the Green Lantern one, the hubcaps are the Green Lantern insignia.
Right.
Which is really cool. And the windows are tinted green, which is really cool.
Oh,
and
I hadn't seen that.
It's not really obnoxious looking, the Green Lantern one. The Flash one has a huge Flash symbol right on the hood of the car. Like, that's pretty hard to miss.
Right.
And the Aquaman one I kind of like. Like, it's so weird, the Aquaman one.
Yeah, because how do you do, you know, well, it has kind of like, almost like fins on the side of it to kind of simulate, gills. It has like gills on the side of the car.
Even so, it's kind of cool. Like, they're all really cool. And yeah, I was kind of disappointed. Like, they're only making one of each of these. That was a little disappointing.
Well, hey, get in the auction, man.
Right, yeah, I'm sure I stand a chance of winning one of those.
That is pretty cool.
But nevertheless, so some interesting things. In about a month, less than a month now, Clayton and I are going to see the three surviving members of the Monkees.
Oh, yeah.
Michael Nesmith, Mickey Dolenz, Peter Tork, they're coming to the area. We're going to see them. It's less than a month away. I'm very, very excited about this. I've never had the opportunity to see Michael Nesmith live. However, several people did this past weekend, as his mini tour of the United Kingdom went down over the last couple of days. October 28th, 29th, and 30th, I believe, were the dates. He started in Glasgow. He ended up in Manchester. He also played London along the way. He played a series of concerts, which he had cryptically said to fans would be more electronic than what they were expecting. Now, he probably said that because one of the last concert recordings of his that was released was from the Brit Fest back in 1992, where it is what you would expect from him. It's a couple of guitars, it's keyboard, percussion, bass, sometimes a ukulele. It's exactly what you would think. And, of course, Hawaiian pedal steel guitar. That is his sound, in a nutshell. It was with enormous curiosity that I awaited any kind of anything relating to these concerts of his, and I had forwarded one of the reviews to you.
You did?
I did. Did you not get that?
No, I never saw it. When did you send it? During the storm, when I was evacuating?
I don't know. It was the first time I ever used one of those websites where it says, share this with your friend. And I clicked on it, and I put your email address in there, and it said, we sent it.
Maybe it went to spam.
Maybe. I'll never do that again. It seems like those functions never work.
And very often they're coming from weird sources that, you know, my email client probably thinks is spam, so it puts it right in that folder. So it was Mike Nesmith. I'm just going to do a little Google search here. Michael Nesmith concert. Or no, it was Monkees.
No, this is him by himself. These are... the reviews have been mixed, if you're curious. And I think they're mixed for this reason. One, the people who are rabid fans of his, like myself, would be delighted to see him get up on stage and do anything. He could cough into a microphone for 3 hours and still get a standing ovation. However, if you take a more objective point of view, and I had the opportunity because, to my amazement, the Monkees website posted it. They posted a full audio recording of the Scotland concert. Like the day after it happened, which I listened to immediately. Even as my iPad was dying, I was thinking, if this is the last thing before the universe ends when nuclear apocalypse Sandy makes landfall,
right?
This is all right. I'm going out, listen to this. What he meant by it being extremely electronic, and as you start to see photos that fans took at this concert, he's like surrounded by an array of iPads and MacBooks. And there's a guy who is only playing the MacBook.
Right. Yeah, I mean...
It's Nez. It's Joe Chimay, his longtime bassist, who's been with him since Infinite Rider on the Big Dogma in the late 70s. And this other guy who, like, plays a computer.
That's fascinating. You know, because he's always been out in front on digital technology and trends in music and just media in general. Yeah. Not just to say music, but media in general. And... You know, there has, you know, whether it's using computer technology or different programs like GarageBand on the iPad, you know, music producers are able to use this and crank out some pretty incredible stuff. And so I can imagine that, and you know, I have to be honest with you, we have bands every week on the show on Fox and Friends, and whenever I walk by their soundboard, their sound guy, because they always travel, you know, even like Los Lonely Boys, they have like their sound guy that comes with them, and it's all hooked up to a massive board that they bring in. It's all being powered and run by a MacBook Pro. So now the guy who's playing, was the guy playing an iPad, or he's playing the computer, like hitting certain things on a trackpad kind of thing?
Well, that I don't know. But, you know, both fan reviews, and there's actually one review, that's what I had forwarded to you, that like a London paper did of the concert. And it was clearly written by like a fan who hated the show. He was a longtime Michael Nesmith fan, and he hated the show. But I can understand why. To give you a sense of what the content of these are, because I almost didn't want to know what he was playing until I could listen to the concert myself, and then I accidentally saw a review that had the complete set list in it. He only plays two Monkees era songs. He plays all of his stuff roughly in chronological order from the time he, in terms of when he wrote the song, not when it was released. And there's something from almost all of his landmark albums. The three first National Band albums are represented, and The Hits Just Keep On Coming is there, Tropical Campfires is there, Infinite Rider on the Big Dogma, Radio Engine of the Photon Wing, and three songs from The Prison, which is really surprising.
Yeah,
there are
the
no
30th...
songs.
Sorry.
What's that?
I was going to say, and I'm on monkeys.net right now, and it's because, what, the 30th anniversary of The Prison, so maybe that's why they're doing like a special box set of it? Did you see this?
No, maybe that just broke today.
Michael Nesmith, The Prison Special. We have an unusual radio show.
Right, that's a radio show that's happening in England this weekend.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're going to play The Prison in its entirety without interruption.
Oh, okay.
Which is really odd. But anyway, he plays nothing off Tantamount to Treason, which is not all that surprising. Disappointing, of course, because that's where Wax Minute is. He plays nothing from The Garden, which is the sequel to The Prison, but that's largely instrumental, so that doesn't surprise me. And thankfully, he plays nothing from Rays, his most recent album, which is kind of like a bag of poop.
Right. But absolutely terrible. Right.
Unfortunately, the vast majority of this concert is like his songs through the lens of Rays. If you ever wondered what like a half techno version of different drums sounds like, you're going to find out.
Mm.
And my fear is when his, you know, this Monkees tour that's coming up, which is just 12 dates, he said in 2013 he's going on the road in the U.S. to do a full solo concert tour, and he's very ominously implied that this is probably the last time he's ever going out performing publicly. My fear is that this was the warm-up for what that show is going to be. And in that way, it's a little disappointing. It's not what you want to hear from him. In fact, he'd be better served standing up there just playing acoustic guitar, accompanying himself without the other players. But there are a couple things about him that, one, he doesn't really enjoy playing live. Two, over the years, he's really, like, fallen out of practice as a guitar player. And you can hear that in this concert. Like, sometimes he just forgets what he's playing. Even in Different Drum, he forgets some of the lyrics. That's like his signature song is Different Drum. And he forgets some of the lines. So that's very disappointing. There were some pleasant surprises. He played Casablanca Moonlight, which is one of my very favorite Michael Nesmith songs. And I don't think he ever played that live before. He does explain to the audience, when he comes back out to do an encore, he does a very unusual song as an encore, that they use, you know, the MacBooks or whatever to play the actual original pedal steel part by the late, great Orville J. Red Rhodes Jr. They play the exact thing that you hear from the album as, like, the pedal steel solo in that song. But my feeling is, as I said, the reason the reviews are mixed are people want him out on the road. The people that are fervent fans of him, they want a chance to see him, especially with all the rumors about his failing health going around. They want to stand up and appreciate this man for what he is one last time, if this really is the last time he's going out on the road. But on the other hand, the concert does seem really disappointing in that it's overdone. It's a lot of electronica going on in the background. Sometimes in the mix of the sound, it overwhelms the sound of him singing and the guitar. And it's weird. In addition to which, and this is above all others perhaps, has a tendency to be self-indulgent with these things. He tells these elongated stories about every song, And what the reviewer in the London paper wrote, and I agree with entirely, is he's ruining what your subjective interpretation of the song is by telling you these things. And he does it for every single song that he plays. So it was obviously with bated breath that I awaited hearing anything about these. And then I got to hear the full Glasgow show. I read a lot of reviews by fans, including this one that was published in the London paper. And I'm just kind of like, oh, no. Oh, no. And worse, because you know as well as I do, he's an extraordinarily temperamental man. My real fear is he's going to read all these negative reviews that are out there, and he's going to go, well, then the heck with it. I'm not going out on the road after all. Which is basically what happened when he was on tour with the Monkees in the late 90s. They did those Wembley Stadium shows where all the reviews said, you know, Davey, Mickey, and Peter seemed fine. Mike's voice was terrible. He couldn't remember the chords to his own songs. He didn't seem like he belonged up there on stage. And you know what? Days later, he said, guess what? I'm not doing the North American part of the tour. And he went home.
Interesting. I don't know. I mean, I feel like maybe to keep it fresh for himself, he feels like the need to you know, freshen up the songs using some weird new, you know, incarnation of electronica mixed with his classic sound. It doesn't make sense to me. I mean, when people go to see a show like that, they want to hear – I mean, look, they don't want to hear the album, mm-hmm. right? But they want to hear it as close as possible with, like, a little bit of flair. You know, give
right.
– they're going out to – the folks are going out to Applebee's beforehand, right? They're eating good in the neighborhood. The big night out for the first time in a while. They're going to go see a Mike Nesmith show. You
right.
know, they want to go see this guy that they like a lot. They're talking about it at the Applebee's beforehand. They're saying, you know, hope he plays this. I hope he plays that. I wonder if he'll play this from the Monkees. I wonder if he'll play this from, you know, First National Band days. It'd be really, you know, I can't wait. And then you get there and you hear this weird electronica stuff and you're just like looking at your wife going, what? Something. Is Applebee's still open?
Yeah, he does. He does play. You know, what are his hits? And I'm saying that in air quotes. You can't see. He does those. He does do some interesting album choices, and all that. And like I said, you can hear that the audience is just excited to see him. But it seems really like deflating. And you know, he last performed his solo stuff. You know, by himself. 20 years ago. It's not like Dave Matthews Band, who are on tour like 200 days a year, and they're like, you know, how do we keep Ants Marching fresh after the last 600 times we've performed it, which is one of the songs they do virtually every night in concert. Like, I can't believe that he's one of those guys who's like, man, it's so boring playing these songs. Like, you know what these need? Like 8 more synthesizers behind them. I can't go out there and play Tomorrow and Me without more synthesizers. But that really does seem to be what it is right now. Like,
it is true.
It's,
I mean, it's like
a little disheartening.
It's not like you're so sick of these songs. You're like, God, every night, figure out how to freshen this up. Let's do it, you know, Hell Freezes Over, Hotel California style. Let's figure right. something out here.
Yeah, oh, well. It is a little lackluster.
So will you be disappointed if it is like a jazzed up, you know, Michael Nesmith, when you go see him?
If it was more jazz and less techno, I think I'd be thrilled. I will just be excited to see him.
And
I don't think
to be clear, there's no tour announced yet.
That's exactly right. Like, the only thing, and like I said, one, you know, he's extraordinarily well off, and two, he's very temperamental.
And three, like, he's old.
Right.
And looking at those pictures of him on monkees.net,
yeah.
I mean, again, he's bald, he looks old. I just wonder what the dynamic is going to look like on stage. If it'll feel just a little too kitsch, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if they'll have embarrassing like 60s photos of them like flashing up on some giant screen.
Oh, you know they will, because they've talked about this multimedia tribute they're going to be doing to Davy Jones. So, I have no doubt there's going to be tons of that sort of thing. And you know, Mickey Dolenz, who's been out touring in support of his new solo album, on the recent concert tours that he's done, including that stop at B.B. King's, which was recorded, that's going to be released as a CD live at B.B. King's with Mickey Dolenz. He's the one singing Davy's songs now. Like, he sings Daydream Believer. There was at least one other really notable Davy song that he sings, Valerie. So, which is probably for the best, because Peter's never had the most marketable voice, and Mike's voice has seen better days. So, I think what we're going to see is, and it depends, like, you know, to keep him happy, I think Nez is probably going to be, like, the one holding the reins of this Monkees tour, which probably means we're going to see a little bit of this, like a concert run from a MacBook. They're going to have, like, a multimedia presentation that they're running from, like, Mike's iPad. Did you see in that review, by the way, they're like, we're pretty sure at one point he was reading email while he was on stage. like, I think it's going to be a lot of that, but I think it will be very heartfelt.
That's high praise for the iPad.
Right. Like, I think that's what we're in for. But I do think that the vast majority of the vocal duties will be handled by Mickey, who sounds outstanding. He still does. And wow. His new album is really, really good.
I told you, I texted you a picture. He was on the local Fox affiliate here for a morning show interview. I guess the morning of his B.B. King show.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, he looks good. And
he hides it well. He's always got that hat on to cover the fact that, like, his hair is two-thirds of the way back his head. And he's always got those dark glasses on so you can't see his weary eyes. Because if you see him without, like, if you see, like, a fan-taken photo after one of his concerts where he doesn't have the hat and the glasses on, he, like, ages 20 years by taking those off.
He looks – it was funny because I was on the monkees.net. I was looking at some past concerts, archive tour information, and they have, like – so Peter Tork goes on tour by himself.
Oh, yeah, with his own band. Yeah.
And I was like, God, who would go see that?
Yeah, his band is, like, Blue Suede Shoe or something. You're going to freak about this. You know – in the early days of that Borders in our hometown, him and his band played that Borders Cafe, and we didn't even go.
Are you kidding me?
No. I remember that very distinctly, that I thought, am I going over there? Nah, it's Peter.
Wow. Why didn't we? We could have at least gotten a chai, you know, at the...
Don't get me started. Well, I do want to, as much I could go on and on about Michael Nesmith, but I want to talk about one last thing before we wrap this Long in the Tooth Part 5 Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe up. Oh, incidentally, this is really a strange thing, Clayton. I wrestled on a show over the weekend called Wrestling is Fun. It was up in Allentown. And this show was attended by about 100 paying customers, but it was watched online by thousands, a staggering number of people, because it was streamed out free as a test of this new technology that SmartMark Video has acquired. And for a period of 2 hours, this tiny little show using the hashtag Potassiker was trending in the U.S., which is unbelievable to me.
That's awesome.
It really wasn't until later, until they found out almost 3,500 people at one time were watching the live stream, that I realized, well, no wonder. Because I thought, I don't think all these people in here are tweeting right now.
Right. Yeah, using the hashtag. There you go. So they were all online, just around the world watching it, right?
It was. Yeah, it was watched in something ridiculous. Like 50 different countries were watching this thing, which is crazy. And they're going to do it again, incidentally. If you want to watch some family-friendly live pro wrestling, they're doing it again on November 17th as kind of like a final test of this new technology, the streaming technology or whatever you want to call it. But this time of year, and, you know, of course, today is Halloween, so I'm looking forward, as I'm sure you are tonight, to going out with little ones doing trick-or-treating and things like that. We do so much kibitzing here on the program that oftentimes, and this season kind of recalls for me, as we move toward Thanksgiving, a need to be perhaps more grateful about some of life's simple pleasures. When things are very hectic, things get you down, life serves you up a bowl full of sour yuck. Sometimes it's important to reflect on the things which we overlook. And I think trick-or-treating is one of those great simple pleasures of life. And you only get it once a year.
I agree.
You only get it once a year. When you get that cup of coffee that is made exactly the way you want it to taste, and I think about that Borders chai that has disappeared off the face of the planet, like that was one of life's true simple pleasures.
Yeah, I agree. And I get that now with an expertly made pumpkin spice latte at Starbucks, which I enjoy. Now, I enjoy it nowhere near the level of enjoyment that I had for the Borders chai.
Yes.
But forgive me if I'm misremembering this, but didn't it have whipped cream, the Borders chai?
Mm-mm. No, it didn't.
Mm. Okay. But anyway, the pumpkin spice latte does.
Mm-hmm.
And with a little sprinkle of pumpkin, whatever they put on top of it. Oh, just delicious. But I agree, even just like the carving of the pumpkin. You know, the other day my son was really excited after his nap. We said we were going to carve the pumpkin, and he just loved it, you know, and just,
yeah.
Just forget these like little things. You know, we had the power outage at the house, and we had one pumpkin left that we hadn't yet carved. And so we got it. It was in the dark, you know, which is not smart with a knife, but fortunately it was daylight.
Especially for your little one.
Yeah, and we carved up the pumpkin and had a nice little hour of fun doing that with no power on. And you realize, like, the little things in life that matter more than, you know, having to watch, like, you know, TV episodes of things that he wants to watch or different things like that. Like, just the family time, the quality time, and together. And I'm excited because I want to see him. This is his first real Halloween trick-or-treating. Like, last year he was a little too young, and we kind of took him to downtown Holly, Pennsylvania, where they had, like, a little, like, all the vendors, the stores kind of opened up. You could go into each of the store and get candy that way.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be the first year where we go door-to-door tonight, and hopefully if the weather holds up. And he's excited because he's got his Batman costume on.
Which Batman is he?
Dark Knight.
Oh.
He's Dark Knight Batman.
I see.
And our little baby girl is going as Catwoman.
Mm.
So he's thrilled about this. We test drove the costume a few weeks ago, or like a week ago, and he loved it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you never know, right? You get like a little mask, and you worry, like, oh, I don't want to wear the mask. You know, like they get freaked out because they don't want to put this thing on their face.
Mm-hmm.
But your son last year, what did he go as last year?
He was the brave and the bold version of Batman.
Ah, nice.
So, you know, they make like all these different variant Batman costumes you can get. Some have muscles in them, some don't. Some are like more deluxe, some aren't. But yeah, he was brave and the bold Batman, you know, which is like blue and gray as opposed to the black tones. So, and this year he'll be Woody from Toy Story. And he looks very good as Woody. This came as a real surprise because in the home stretch, after having changed his mind about 30 times, he kept pushing to be Hawkeye. And secretly, I had tremendous pride that my son was pushing to be Hawkeye.
Now,
he wanted to be comic book Hawkeye.
Oh, that's impossible.
Like, I had no idea where this was coming from. Like, Hawkeye? I think what it is he has, like, a toy suction cup bow and arrow. And he was looking for, like, maybe in his mind he reverse-engineered a costume where he could carry this suction cup bow and arrow. But when that came out, I was like, Hawkeye. I was like, oh, that is such my boy. And But he wanted to be comic book Hawkeye, and that costume's not out there. Movie Hawkeye is out there, and movie Hawkeye does not look like comic book Hawkeye at all.
No, and it'd be kind of weird because he'd almost be like shirtless with like a vest.
Right, it's cold out.
Yeah, and a quiver. Like he's kind of like shirtless or like has like a t-shirt on. That's not really cold weather. You'd be better off sending him as like Pikachu. It'd be nice and warm then. Pokemon.
I don't think he knows what that is. He only just, I think like a week ago, figured out what Power Rangers were. So I think Pikachu is beyond him, but...
Are you going to dress up with him?
Yeah, I thought about that. I thought about that, but I don't think that I will.
Yeah.
I certainly have plenty of costumes here around the house. But I was thinking about, too, I know these don't exist anymore. I believe they were made by a company called Cooper. But I used to love getting those, like, boxed Halloween costumes where, you know, it just had, like, that plastic...
the mask with the rubber band attached to it.
That super thin piece of elastic that snapped the first second you did anything disagreeable with it.
Right.
And
yeah, it always broke off. It had the staple in the side of the mask. And they would get real sweaty underneath the mask.
Right, too. Yeah. Your hot breath, it would like, you know, collect the condensation in there. The costume would rip, you know, if you made too egregious a movement. And it did seem like those costumes were waiting to burst into flame.
Ben Cooper was the maker of those costumes.
That's it.
Ben Cooper.
You know, there's a collector's market for those things now.
I bet so. A translucent Halloween mummy mask sold by Ben Cooper Incorporated in the 1960s. Yeah, C-3PO from 1977.
I had a Spider-Man costume. One year I was Spider-Man, and my Ben Cooper costume, rather than looking like the Spider-Man costume, it was a Spider-Man mask and then like a trash bag that they had like, you know, like a picture of Spider-Man swinging, and on your chest was the, you know, the written out logo like from the comic book that said The Amazing Spider-Man. It didn't look like a Spider-Man costume.
Right. Like, I remember the pants. I remember you wearing that, too. Like, I mean, it was like...
I wore it to school.
Yeah. It was like a brown and red... Or, sorry, blue and red pants. But that sort of
didn't
like
make
plastic
sense.
Pants.
You know? Or, like, one year, there was a Batgirl costume where the Bat logo should have been. It just said Batgirl. The word spelled out. Like, what? How hard could it have been to...
this?
You're obviously licensing the character, right?
you remember this, too, in the early 1980s? There was this big scare over the Cooper costumes because, like, some kids died. Do you remember this?
No.
I'll look this up.
Is this an urban myth?
No, here it is. Here it is. Okay, I'm not imagining this. The company suffered heavy financial losses in the early and mid-1980s. Beginning on September 29th, 1982, seven people died after taking the painkiller Tylenol. Investigators said someone had tampered with the product, lacing it with potassium cyanide. Terrified parents nationwide refused to allow their children to celebrate Halloween the following month, and sales of the costumes plummeted and did not recover for several years.
Okay. Well, that I do remember, the Tylenol thing.
Yeah, I thought it was related to like kids suffocating or something like that.
Right, I couldn't get that mask off their face. You couldn't keep it on your face.
Right, it wouldn't stay on at all.
Right. I was going to say, like, kids were trapped in those? I don't know. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Despite its setback in 84, the firm was still the largest supplier of Halloween costumes. That's crazy. Huh. So in the late
1980s.
Yeah, late 1989, their company, their facility in Georgia burned to the ground.
Hmm. Well, that just proves, yeah, you know how they used to try and tell you those were flame retardant?
Right.
Obviously not. Obviously not. The whole place went up in like half an hour.
That's crazy. I would love to see just a
Rogues
Gallery.
They always smelled of weird chemicals, like, ugh.
I just want to see like a Rogues Gallery of these costumes, because I only see two. I see like just a translucent Halloween mask, an early mummy mask from the 1960s. That's about it, though. I don't see. I just want like I would love just a model list number of photos of these classic costumes. I'm sure there's some great ones in there.
I'm sure there are. You know, the co-host of the Weekly Long Box, Leonard, often talks about he had one of the Cooper costumes. It was his favorite when he was a kid. He was the Fonz.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, he talks about that more often than you would think that would come up in conversation. I want to throw this out there, too, as we're getting toward the end of the program here, about a simple pleasure. And I don't really have these on my PC anymore, but I used to. I'm sure somewhere I have these discs if I was going to break them out. But I used to have these kind of video games where they were the kind of video games where as the night was waning and you were telling yourself, I need to go to bed, you started to concoct a story about how you're going to call out from work the next day.
Right.
So you could stay home and continue to play these games. And these games to me were games like Alpha Centauri, which was one of the Sid Meier, like, take over a planet and repopulate it games.
Right.
Freedom Force, which was a role-playing game, superhero style game, which I remember playing at the same time that I was writing Headquarters. And it was the same winter when you had first sent me John Mayer's Room for Squares, and a game called Roller Coaster Tycoon, which I'm sure still exists in some form, is still out there. But I kind of missed that. That was a very simple pleasure. You know, you'd go out and buy this like $30 video game, and then for several days at a time, it would just take over your life.
Oh yeah, like Dragon Warrior for me. Mm. I school was in the way of Dragon Warrior for me. And I just couldn't. And I would sit in school and I would like map out in my head. And I would draw on paper as well, like the way they get through these levels. I would do the same thing with like Metroid. Mm-hmm. I would sit in class and I would sit and draw Load Runner screens. Remember Load Runner?
Yes, of course.
And I would map out different ways of building Load Runner levels on graph paper. You need graph paper to be able to do it.
Yeah.
By the way, I just sent you.
This is the perfect example of these costumes.
Yeah, I just sent you them. Do you get it?
Right. Like, the Rubik's Cube thing just has a picture of a Rubik's Cube on the chest.
Like, and then with the Rubik's Cube mask.
Right. Flipper has the word Flipper written across it and a picture of a dolphin.
Right.
Like, no, you're the dolphin. Like,
here is – oh, my gosh. Here's the one – this Wonder Woman outfit. Oh, here's – yeah, here's a Wonder Woman one. I remember this. I think my sister was Wonder Woman one year. Mm. I definitely remember this. And the Smurfs outfit, right? It just said Smurfs, and they had like it had like blue pants and then the Smurf head.
Yeah. It was like clearly made by someone who'd never watched the Smurfs. Or, right. You know? Like, we're not really sure what Batman looks like, but we should probably pay some money to have the license to make those Halloween costumes.
And the Dukes of Hazzard costumes.
Oh, yes.
Boss Hogg.
Right. Whoever wanted to go as Boss Hogg.
Right.
Right? Like, I could go as Bo or Luke. Nah, nah, nah. I want to be Boss Hogg. I want to be Enos. That's what I want to go as. So.
Did they ever make any Monkees versions of these?
I know that there were, like, those Ben Cooper-style Monkees masks, because I've seen those in, like, you know, books or things that talk about collectibles from the Monkees. I've seen them photographed. I don't know if they did the full costumes or not, but, man, when they were hot, they made every stupid kind of thing with the Monkees on it you could ever think of.
I think this is the Spider-Man costume.
Like, the top part was kind of like a yellowish-orange where there was, like, a picture of him.
Yeah.
Is that the one that you found?
Here is, well, I'm going to send this one to you because I don't know if this is the right one or not, but this is definitely a Ben Cooper outfit that just sold on eBay. Masters of the Universe. I think it had some good ones back then. Mm. Banana splits, like a monkey. It's a good thing we ended the show a while ago, right?
Right.
E.T.
No, this is not the Spider-Man costume that I had.
Yeah, I didn't think so. Cabbage Patch.
Right. Who's this Masters of the Universe one here with the white face?
Right.
Or is it just sun bleached? Is that what it is?
No, I think that's. Yeah, I don't know.
Supposed
which one
to be somebody?
Stonedar. Stonedar was his name. Do you see that? Who the hell is Stonedar?
Don't you remember there were two of them, and there's another one who's named like Rock King or whatever, and they just like bent over and turned into rocks. Do you remember them? They were horrible figures. Horrible.
I don't remember them. I don't remember ever seeing them. I don't remember ever seeing them in the show.
Wow. The next time I see you, I have a great issue of Tomart's Action Figure Guide that has a photo of every single Masters of the Universe figure ever made and a few that never even went into production. And I will show you who they are. And the second you see them, you'll be like, those are two of the dumbest toys I've ever seen in my life.
Who would want to go as Stonedar?
Right. No. Yeah. Only $20 now. It's probably $4 back in the 80s for this costume, but $20 now.
That's great. That's awesome. Anyway.
Right. We really got off into strange territory here at the end of the program. So now, in light of Hurricane Sandy, we may push back a week or two, having Glenn Phillips of Toad the Wet Sprocket here on the program. So you have a little more time, if there's anything you need for us to ask, of Toad the Wet Sprocket frontman Glenn Phillips to get that over to us.
Yeah, do that on our Facebook page or just tweet us any questions you have for Glenn Phillips. Glenn and I were writing last night and said, yeah, with the storm, power outages, sorry, we have to push it back. And he was totally understanding and just wanted to make sure everyone was safe and sound. So our thanks to Glenn. We'll move that back a little bit in a few weeks here. So just get your thoughts over to us. We'll make it happen.
Right. All right.
And that's it. Hey, read my review of the new iPad mini. I just posted that yesterday. So my review, mm-hmm. I've spent over a week with it. So check out my review. You can see my tweets at Clayton Morris on Twitter, and I've tweeted it there. You can check out him. He is at Mike Quackenbush on Twitter.
True.
And this show is at Grizzly Bear Cafe. Drop the egg when you find us on Twitter, and we will see you again next week here on the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe.
Goodbye now.